Session Committee on Budget Restoration. As you see from the agenda, we have somewhat of a vague process here. That's my bad news. My good news is those of you that are long-distance runners, we are going to be here a very long time this evening. And as bills are actually produced from LC, they will be brought up and we will enter into work session for bill introduction. In the meantime, what we're going to do is have public hearing and testimony on specific items, aspects of this pre-legged stool that I know you're all familiar with that we've been working on. The first aspect and issue I would like to... Am I talking close enough to the mic, Dave? That's the nicest thing anyone said to me today. The first aspect we'd like to talk about is the bonding piece, in particular master settlement tobacco dollars, and I believe, and I apologize to Treasury for keeping you waiting, so if I could call Treasury up and we can discuss some of the aspects of the quote bonding piece. We have a public hearing on an LC member, but we're not even that far.
Pass it on to Ben for me, please. That's right.
Anyone sign in, please?
Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff.
We have to be quiet. Go ahead.
Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff, Oregon State Treasury.
And Chuck Smith, Oregon State Treasury.
As you know, we've been working on various levels and various proposals. Maybe you could share some of the timeline, some of the costs, some of the aspects from your office's standpoint, point how we can do this, assuming we do this, we can do it in the smartest, most fiscally and responsible manner.
Okay.
It's your show.
You want me to take a run over this?
I'll just give you an overview.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you pointed out, this is a bond-like transaction that we're putting together here, and it is a complex enough transaction that we spent some time today down in LC trying to work it out. I'll give a very quick overview in that this is a sale of the portion of the revenue stream from the master settlement agreement, and it would essentially have we would be selling that revenue stream and selling our rights to it for a period of time, not unlike a bond sale. And I'll let Chuck go ahead and give you kind of the time frames and amounts that we've been looking at.
Thank you, Kate.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to disrupt the flow of the presentation, so do you want us to hold our questions until the end?
Yeah, some of them may need to be answered in your presentation. But if you're actually burning to ask the question, go ahead.
I am burning to ask this one. Kate, when you said that we would sell the anticipated proceeds, sell to whom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, sell to a niche market of those who are buying these tobacco assets. Anyway.
I guess all I'm trying to ascertain is that one of the criticisms that I have heard of those kinds of transactions is how reliable the niche market is in a time of increased corporate scrutiny, whether or not these are offshore entities, whether or not they're Wall Street folks. I presume that niche market is well known to you. Maybe you could give us some details about it in terms of its long-term integrity.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the niche market is American mutual funds primarily, underwriters will purchase these securities and distribute them as they would state bonds. Tobacco securitization or tobacco asset sale bonds have been used by a number of different states. For instance, I just made a brief list here that run from a total of about 8 to 10 billion of these bonds have been done, so that we know they're out there. We know that a number of states have done them. In states, for instance, Arkansas, Alabama, Alaska, Wisconsin, Louisiana, Iowa, South Carolina, New Jersey, Washington is preparing to sell, California is preparing to sell. So currently there's probably 8 to 10 billion of these things outstanding. American mutual funds are the big buyers of these particular kinds of securities. So there's a good market out there. The next step after ascertaining that there is a market for these types of securities is to determine what is the best kind of configuration that we can do for these securities in the state. What is the objective? It's a sort of complex cash flow that surrounds the master settlement agreement because tobacco cash flows vary over time. So it's not as simple as modeling a general obligation bond for 20 years level debt service. So it's sort of a complex model. Today we were working with some underwriters on Wall Street to determine some scenarios on 100, 200, and 300 million. The final product isn't really what we're looking for, but I thought I'd use them as sort of indicative of where we're going on this. And we asked that these numbers be rerun with shorter maturities. We were working today on a final expected maturity of 10 years. We wanted to see if we could get that down into the six-year area, and we're working on it this evening. But nevertheless, the kind of numbers that we were looking at and the costs associated with this, where the interest cost is really the sort of a true measure of cost you ought to be looking here. We're looking at a rate of 5.19%. With a six-year maturity, we ought to get below 5% on these securities. The tobacco sale has ample capacity to do 100, 200, or 300, or actually even more than that. But nevertheless, within the six-year area is where we're targeting. We're looking for interest rates of below 5%. We're looking to make sure that when these computations are done with respect to capacity and so forth, that a set-aside has been allowed for Oregon Health Science University general obligation bond of about $17 million. So we want to make sure that there's $17 million left over to pay, as the legislature had indicated they wanted to earmark about $17 million on an annual basis for those bonds. So those are the kind of computations that are going into this. Interest rates, as you all know, are very favorable. They're favorable in all the debt markets, and that includes tobacco asset sales debt markets.
That was a good question. Do you have any more presentation you want to make?
We'd be happy to respond to additional questions.
I don't want to put you in the devil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Originally, when the tobacco settlement was reached, we were given figures, but we were told in the long term those figures would change, that we would be receiving approximately, I believe it was about $180 million of biennium, somewhere in that range. And then we've been told recently, probably within the last year, that number might be dropping somewhat or maybe even significantly. What is the long-term outlook in terms of what those numbers will be like? And, of course, there was a little bit of confusion, too, in terms of the settlement was supposed to be paid out. Was it over a 25-year period and then the potential in perpetuity, or there's some discussion of that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, payments are to go on forever. Normally, the convention is to take the first 25 years of payments as some sort of, I guess, manageable horizon and use those for computational purposes. I think what we're looking at is if you take an average of payments over a 10-year period, which gives us a good average, and we're looking at about $88 million per year. So that's 176 million dollars a biennial average, if I've added two numbers correctly. The numbers that these the tobacco bonds have utilized as sort of a national standard, they're numbers produced by WEPA. It's an econometric modeling firm. And every single one of the sales of these assets have used WEPA numbers in there. So they're a market standard. And the number I'm quoting to you is the estimate for the state of Oregon, or 10-year average, for WEPA numbers.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. At the interest rates you stated, and if you could please distinguish between, just so we understand, between securitization and traditional bonding and what the difference is. Obviously, you're taking a portion of the revenue stream and basically selling that portion of the revenue stream, as I understand it. So if you did 6 years or 10 years, you would be taking that period and just saying for that period of time only that you would be selling that revenue stream? A portion of the revenue stream.
If the bonds were so structured that they would pay off within 10 years, at the end of 10 years, you would receive the entire master settlement agreement revenue stream from that day forward because you would pay off all your obligations. The difference, I think, in the asset sale is this is really and truly what we're doing is accelerating future payments. These payments are owed to state through this master settlement agreement, and we're trying to accelerate. And I guess you could differentiate that and a regular bond would be borrowing for a particular kind of purpose, whatever state project, capital project, whatnot, and pay that out of your current revenues in the future. So this is an asset that the state is really trying to sell and accelerate its payment by taking a lump sum upfront payment discounted at this interest rate here of about 5.19%.
And Chuck, you may have said this, but it's approximately a third of that revenue stream would be dedicated to the payment.
Well, Mr. Chair, as you shorten the repayment period, you consume more of the anticipated revenues. As you link, it's like an accordion. You pull it out all the way and your payments drop. Just like a 30-year mortgage versus a 15-year mortgage. And as we shorten this up, the payments have to go up substantially in order to pay the bonds, or in this case, the asset sale back in, say, 6 years is what we're shooting, and we should have those numbers tomorrow morning early.
So, Mr. Chairman, in answer to your question, I guess I see where you're going. It wouldn't be the entire revenue stream.
Right.
It would be a portion of it. And as Chuck mentioned, to leaving a residual to the account for
And in fact, 58 from, let's say, revenue, obviously provided by all here, indicates, Richard, that, you know, from this year, looking at approximately $82 million, and then over the course of the next 23, 25 years, it goes up to down near $97 million per year. So, I mean, it's an I don't want to say it's accelerating, but it appears, at least for the foreseeable future, that this payment stream actually goes up.
A couple of questions, Mr. Chair. I'm going to do some rough math in my head, and maybe you can help me with this. We're talking about $88 million a year roughly coming in on the tobacco settlement now, and we're talking about, let's take a figure, $200 million we borrow over 6 years. Looks to me like we're taking a lot more than a third of that each year because the accordion squeezed down, to use your metaphor. So I'm thinking we're looking at $60 million a year taking out that fund, is my math roughly correct?
That's your representative base. It's about $58 or $60 million a year.
Okay, that's my guess. And so we're taking two-thirds of the tobacco settlement over the next 5 to 6 years if we just say we take $200 million as a rough guess. And 5%. So we have something in the ballpark in our minds we'll be looking at tomorrow morning.
And plus that, of course, leaves that additional $17 million set aside to pay for
OHSU.
Service on the OHSU market.
I understand that. Second question, Mr. Chair. Way back, somewhere in my past, in the last few weeks, which seems like years now, I remember hearing something about tobacco settlement money being discounted from the point of view that the market was kind of flooded or something, and that we weren't getting a dollar for dollar on the money we're putting out. Is that not true? Is that one of, you know, urban legends, or is it real?
Representative Bates, the tobacco settlement market is subject to some pretty wide swings in volume. Some of the issues that have come to market, Wisconsin, I think, set a record maybe at $1.6 billion. You know, so they came to market one day at $1.6 billion. That cheapens up tobacco bonds. Tobacco bonds sell at a higher rate of interest than, for instance, the state's general obligation bond. So while this market is sensitive to volume, so we need to sort of try to time our way into the market so we're not trying to do in the same week that somebody else is doing $1.6 billion when we want to borrow $200 million. But there is wide fluctuations. The market can get cheaper at times than others. And even in good times, these interest rates that we're looking on this tobacco asset sale will be higher than the state's general obligation bond because just the nature of the credit.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Our last question here. According to the newspapers, California is sort of doing a big-time Oregon. When do you expect to try to float their tobacco master settlement bonds, and how much money is involved in that? I mean, it will affect the market very much when we try to go in.
Well, California has California has a way of changing the schedules continuously. But they were, I think they were expected in January, February period, and they were looking at $2.5 billion.
A ways out yet.
Yes.
But a big number.
Big number.
I think, Alan, you know, you're saying 60% in 6 years, I'm saying 30% in 12 years. Yeah,
I have no problem taking it back quickly.
Yeah, as long as you know we're doing it.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman.
Somebody talk while I read this note. Somebody name is Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Final question. One of the previous proposals was to back this with cigarette tax revenue for some kind of a revenue bond. What sort of a rate would we have paid on that?
Well, Representative Devlin, for a comparable maturity, I think you're in the same ballpark on these things. But if you extend one, for instance, most of the tobacco asset sales have been longer-term securities. Therefore, they're going to pay a higher interest rate. The further out, the more the interest rate. If you get them both to pay off in about 6 years, you're going to be in roughly the same ballpark.
Thank you.
I was interested in Representative Bates' question about the discount. You talked about it, but what is the biggest discount that's been paid?
Representative Bates, I don't know. I know that interest rates are of close to 6.5% have been paid, so to me that's the way to measure the cost of money.
But this is just chit-chat that we hear that some states have paid 10 or 15 or 20%, or been subject to 10 or 15 or 20% discount.
The representative, some of the tobacco bonds are extraordinarily long-term, like out to 40, 42 years. If you take a look at those kind of long-term period and you compound interest rates like 6.5% over 42 years, you wind up with a relatively small amount of present value in your hand when you sell these things. And maybe that's led to a lot of misunderstanding in what you really wind up with here. If you're taking a look at 6 years, you're looking at a very short period of time and you're looking for very little sort of, if you want to use the word discounting, and I think maybe the interest rate's a better way to capture that.
That answers it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Thank you very much. We'd like to hear from the legislative representative on this, Mr. Warner.
Mr. Chair, the Legislative Council is working on the draft of an LC that contains the Master Settlement Agreement amounts, and that should be available to you by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So you will have a draft in your hands to look at that time. The amount, the bill that you will see will have a blank in it, so in terms of the amount, so of course the amount and will be the key factor in what the repayment is, and as Treasury has pointed out, another key issue is the maturity of that. So the major policy issues are the initial amount, target amount, and the repayment period that you have. Those would be the key policy decisions for you. The other element of the draft that Treasury has been very involved in, why it's not available to you tonight, is the setting up of the process, which does have a series of states have done this. There's some model legislation, and that's being incorporated into this bill. And that's frankly the reason why it's taking a little longer than we thought it would, to make sure that those are set up properly so Treasury has the flexibility to go to the market.
I would also, Mr. Chair, we do keep a track of the Master Settlement Agreement payments, and as you mentioned, Dickie Ace and my staff has run a recent estimate. I will make that available to the committee, so that you can see what we're projecting on a year-by-year basis. The reason for it, as the Chair pointed out, we do expect some growth. There's two reasons. One, there's an additional payment called a strategic payment as part of the settlement that comes in 2008. And the other factor is there is an inflation adjustment factor that comes into play. The key risk behind that revenue stream is what's called a volume adjustment, which reflects the amount of shipment, value of shipments nationally of cigarettes. There was an initial drop in that volume, basically because the major tobacco companies, when the settlement was reached with the states, essentially raised their prices to offset their anticipated costs, much like they reacted much like a national excise tax increase. So that's why you saw a roughly 14% drop in sales in the first year after the settlement. Since that time, we think it's going to drop in the neighborhood of 3% or so a year and be offset by the inflation adjustment factor.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Morgan.
Looking over Mr. Warner's shoulder here, what it appears to be is that the volume goes down over time, but the actual adjusted total payments go up over time. Can you talk, is that the inflation factor?
Representative Morgan, yes, that's correct. The inflation factor offset the volume adjustment factor in our estimates in the out years. The volume adjustment, the key is what the companies do with prices. And given that they basically priced in their anticipated effects of the master settlement, we think that the volume will drift down as smoking declines over time, but not at a rapid rate. And that will be more than offset by the inflation adjustment factor plus the strategic payments that come in beginning in the year 2008.
Thank you.
What effect do what I guess they call offshore cigarettes that really aren't subject to any of the Master Settlement Agreement, is that becoming a larger and larger portion of the market, or are you aware?
That's an issue. We have Dick Yates in the audience.
He's our
tobacco expert. Look at that. That is a tobacco expert.
Unwilling witness.
This is legislative revenue. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, sir. Well,
the question
this
is
evening, where I come from.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, speaking of morning and evening, I confess that Mr. Yates was at his desk at 7:30 Sunday morning. Nobody else was.
Yeah, we were here in the committee waiting for it. So with the what about these offshore? How big an impact is that having on the sales, which the settlement is pegged to?
It depends on whether or not they become parties to the agreement, which is an option that they have. If they do, then there's no effect. To the extent that they do not, then it does reduce the market share of the six companies, essentially, that are involved in the master settlement agreement. And to the extent that their share of the national market goes down, that lowers their payment nationally, and Oregon gets a 6% of the national compensation.
Okay. Can you quantify that? I understand the mechanism by hydraulics.
Well, I made the best estimates I could in those. We might be able to get the LEAP estimates, but I think they're price tag is about $3,000. I think part of the answer, if I may continue, is that all of the states, the attorney general offices in all of the states that are parties to this agreement have accepted the responsibility of enforcing the agreement. So what happens to the payment depends on the essentially degree of enforcement that they attain nationally. And to the extent that the states put resources into the enforcement of those agreements, then there'll be more money flowing in. So it's kind of hard to estimate.
Yeah. Any questions for Mr. Yates? Thank you very much. You're an excellent, if not reluctant, witness. I don't know what else there is to say about the National Settlement Agreement unless anyone in the audience wishes to testify regarding MFA and potential utilization of that revenue stream as a solution to part of the problem. Anyone in attendance? Raise your hand. Grab a hold of the key. We'll have a public hearing when we get the formal bill, too. So, I know it's a little tough. I mean, you're sitting there, it's still tough on us. I mean, we're sitting here looking at air trying to craft public policy as it's being written. Anyway, we'll close the public hearing on LC blank, and we will we're about ready to get a plethora of bills dropped on us. Does the committee have any preferences to what they would like to discuss at this time?
Mr. Chair, we're expecting
LC draft. Yeah, we're expecting LC draft on the ballot title. We're expecting LC draft on program changes. We have introduced the tax bill, contrary to some of the reports you may have heard from some of my good colleagues from across the aisle this afternoon. But that is in the possession of the committee, and I'm reluctant to discuss that without Representative Bates, Shetterly, and all right. Theodore and President Shetterly, who's on his way back. You need me to sign some stuff? Thank you.
those word program changes, ballot titles, Scott's got to go back, get those signed by the speaker, and put the copies back up for everybody. Match dental appropriations bill is being computed. Let's just take a short recess on this. Paul could tell Joe to sing. We'll take a quiet recess. That'd make me go down to Magoo to get you one more time. The FDIC report is hopefully were being distributed two LPs, one relating to the LP20 is the ballot title explanatory statement language, and LP22-1, the program change bill. Both are fairly non-controversial, not very exciting, but potential steps in this process. I will open a work session for bill introduction of LP20.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just for clarification also for folks in the audience, the current appropriate version of LP20 is one that has the caption 9902 as the date -1. And the measure, as you indicated, is an election-related issue. It's linked to legislative concept number 17, and it does provide the ballot title, financial impact statement, and explanatory statement for the November general election. That's because of the short time frame to get an item on that ballot. Because of the short time frame as well and deadlines for local governments to print absentee ballots for general election and mailing the ballots for long-term absentee electors, this LC does provide a blank amount for an appropriation from the general fund to the emergency board for expenditures that might be incurred by local governments in producing timely the ballots and any additional work that may be necessary in voting pamphlets.
Thank you. Any questions of staff? Ms. Morgan?
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 20 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Morgan has moved that LC 20 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chairman, there's no objection, but that's typical caveat.
Could you just get a sign? I understand.
I will join my colleague, Mr. Devlin, with the traditional caveat, so I don't want him to feel alone.
We'll try to make it to three of us here.
Mr. Chairman, I will join my esteemed colleague.
Can you just join us?
Oh,
yeah, the budget buddies aren't budgeting, you know. Any further discussion? Any objection? LC20 is introduced. In the work session on LC20 and open the work session for budget or for bill introduction purposes for LC22-1. Dallas? What are you doing here?
We're doing many things, Mr. Chairman of the committee. LP22-1 essentially adds $2.6 million to the general fund, $2 million from the sale of the Boardman property in Space Age Industrial Park, which is reflected here by changes in the allocation of the percentages of the net sales proceeds, putting 77% in the general fund versus the 50, or add $2 million to the general fund, and reduce it. The corresponding amount from the place in the Trust for Cultural Development account. The other portion that we add.
I just want to make sure I understand the math correctly. The sale of the Boardman is 3.2.
No. Okay, I'll walk you through the math.
Thank you.
Yeah. The sale price is 7.6.
The money's a secure deposit has been received, and they're in the process of partitioning the land. Went a little more slowly than expected. $200,000 in expenses have been incurred, so there's net proceeds of $7.4 that are expected. 77% would be of that $7.4 transfer, about $5.7 million to the general fund of the $7.4 and $1.7 million to the Trust for Cultural Development. Out of that $1.7 of the Trust for Cultural Development, the Emergency Board has already authorized the Communications staff to pay $500,000 to Morrill County, which is part of its existing statute. So as the 7.4, the original 50% that was to go to the general fund would translate into roughly $3.7 million, which was the bill was introduced and passed into law during the second special session. That was an additional recourse to the general fund. This would add an additional $2 million from that. So that the 77% converts into $5.7 million out of the 7.4 versus 50%, which would have been $3.7 million.
When we're all said and done with all of the changes, all the math, because I'm frankly having a little bit of a tough time following with the math, what does this leave in the trust?
$1.2 million.
What does this, and then?
Oh, no, this will be deposited into the trust for cultural development. $1.2 million out of the net $7.4 million.
But then what about Morrill County?
Oh, I've taken that off the top. It would be $1.7 into the trust. Of that, $500,000 is committed to Morrill County.
And I just want to make sure that these reductions to, because that's supposed to be 7.6, is turned into 7.4, 6.4, which was originally designated to go to the trust, $1 million to Morrill County.
That's correct.
They are being proportionally reduced.
That is correct. Originally, the bill had $1 million to Morrill County and $6.4 million to the Trust for Cultural Development. The change when we apportioned it 50% to general fund, 50% to the trust, reduced the distribution from by half to the trust, so they reduced the distribution of Morrill County by half from $1 million to $500,000.
Is this consistent with the discussions that occurred relative to a potential trust list last month?
I wasn't privy to that.
Yeah. And I just, for further iteration, I called Mr. Coleman from Morrill County and said, okay, this is what's happening. Don't like it, but this is where we are. He said, fine.
So
is this consistent with what we see on this cut list?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It adds $2 million to the general fund, right?
Yeah, it's 2 points. $2.2 million.
Yeah.
2.2.
Yeah, this is
2.2.
Well, that's the number
Dallas
just
said. No, he said 2.
I didn't see that. I told you. Well, I see 2.2 here. That's what we agreed last night. So, yeah.
To rework the numbers? We would have to change the percentages to get to the 2.2.
Can you conceptually?
Sure, or you can amend and then change them in the bill. Get to 2.2.
You can amend when you get it back.
Yep. So it's just a matter of changing these percentages.
Okay. Make sure you get amendments drafted to that effect to request a 2.2 proportional reduction.
with Morrill County Health Harmless Assessment.
No, proportional reduction.
Okay.
Let me just make sure I got this straight. So Morrill County agreed to take a 50% reduction in their intersection. Okay, so that's another 250,000 that will go to trust.
But not to exceed a million.
The trust would get 1 million, and that's kind of
old. Right.
Yeah. For being in just the math, the trust is 1 million.
Right.
And that's what they agreed on.
Right.
And that's what the general fund. And Morgan agreed to go from 500,000 to 250. So adjust the math.
Got it.
Well, the general fund's going to get more money.
The general fund will get more money. It should be, if Morrill County goes from 500,000 to 250, then the general fund should go off by 250.
1350.
Not the 200. Mm-hmm.
So 50,000 plus for the general fund.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough.
Close enough.
That's what we agreed to.
We can do that.
Thank you, Ben. Keep going.
The other change was the transfer of what appeared to be an excess amount from the Department of Justice operating account of 600,000 to statutorily transfer that amount to the general fund.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a couple of other amendments in the bill that have nothing to do with the budget, as a federally recognized Indian tribe as could be a recipient of money out of the cultural trust.
Right. And let me explain that for anyone who cares. When the bill was originally drafted, it indicated that only 501c3s could receive funds, since most tribal governmental entities or sovereign nations, they don't fiddle around with these little bothersome U.S. tax code things called 501c3. So I think it's a legitimate point of identity and pride for the tribes. So they ask that this change be made. Technical amendment.
And then it changes, it adds a couple of members to the board. The 7 members will be appointed by the governor and 2 members appointed by other voting members. And those members must have background on fiscal matters.
Mr. Chair, how many members are there now?
7.
7 for the sake of the people.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And of the 9, the governor appoints 7 the board.
Who have been appointed?
And then set the terms for the members that are appointed by the trust.
The terms,
yeah.
Any questions, Cap? Per the amendment, which will be drafted, we'll send this on. Representative Morgan?
No.
For what?
Mr. Chair, just that on the page 4 on line 11, that the ability of the entity to grant
permissive. Right. Yeah, based on the severe reductions, we had mandatory language that was changed to permissive for granting amounts to counties and tribes using the base amount formulary plus a per capita amount for each tribe. Fair enough.
Yep.
Representative Morgan?
Mr. Chair, I would move that LC-22-1 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Morgan has moved LC-22-1 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chair, in the interest of moving the process along, I will make the conditional disclaimer. I'd be happy to be a yes, now reserving the right to not stick with that position as we process the future.
Let the record show that Representatives Johnson, Devlin, and Bates.
I really think that I should amend my motion, if you would permit me to do that. I would amend my motion to be, I would move that we introduce LC-22-1 as conceptually amended on the dollar amount relating to the transfer of the Boardman property?
We'll change those percentages to make the numbers work.
And that the bill as conceptually amended be introduced as a committee bill.
If we're going to do that, let's do it right. The do I have unanimous consent to suspend the rule for Representative Morgan may withdraw her first motion? Seeing none, our motion is withdrawn. Representative Morgan, would you like to remove?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we introduce LC 22-1. Wait a minute, first we have to conceptually amend it.
Right.
And that I would move that we conceptually amend LC 22-1 to reflect the revised amount in the transfer from the sale of the Boardman property to the general fund and to the Trust for Cultural Development. And Dallas, if you could just reiterate what those amounts would be.
Chairman of the committee, we will change some percentages of the allocation such that the Trust for Cultural Development will actually receive 1.25, $1.25 million, of which 250,000 is going to go to Morrow County there, and then the balance will go to the general fund. We will also have to add a small amendment that reflects that $250,000 change to the amount that goes to Morrow County. There was a provision in the bill that says if the sales price exceeds the amount that's to go to Morrow County, that amount shall go. And it went from $1 million to $500,000. And my understanding was the $500,000 stayed. We will have that change. You'll see that new amount, that dollar amount in the amendment, or in the bill as it will be introduced. So very clear.
I move that conceptual amendment into the bill.
Representative Morgan has moved the conceptual amendment into LC 22-1. Any discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chair, I didn't want to move the process along. I'll be investing now, and I have the opportunity to vote here for me later.
Mr. Chairman, speak after the same statement.
Ditto for Representative Devlin.
I'm
going to just vote that one. Hey, I mean, this guy's with me. You know, I like that.
So,
seeing no objections, LC 22-1 is so conceptually amended.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 22-1 is conceptually amended, be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Morgan has moved LC 22-1 as conceptually amended, be introduced as a committee bill. Let me interrupt these proceedings and let everyone know it is Richard Devlin's birthday today.
Oh. Well, nice way to spend your birthday.
Not a day.
And the Committee on Budget Restoration and heed to the call of our master of masons, the one and only, thank you again for running up here. Every motion we have made here except the first one is out of order because you cannot conceptually amend LCs.
So thank you for your diversion, Representative Johnson. I would now ask Representative Morgan to introduce LC 22-1.
Mr. Chair, I move that we introduce LC 22-1 as a committee bill.
Representative Morgan has moved to introduce LC 22-1 as a committee bill. Representatives Devlin and Johnson are giving courtesy votes to get the bill out of committee, but reserve the right to change their mind. Any further discussion? Any objections? Thank you for your steadfast support, Representative Davis. So moved.
Mr. Chair, if I could, just to clarify, we will be receiving amendments on the bill that reflect the discussion that we had in.
I thank you again very much, Ramon. That's more threatening than Richard Aguirre saying he's watching. We are blessed in this process to have a Ramona Kennedy. She is, and above all else, it's critical we do this right. So I appreciate the professional therapy and help. We will end the bill introduction on LC 22-1, and we will open now that we have full staff, and if anyone is listening down in Legislative Revenue, ask Mr. Warner to come up, and we will open a public hearing on LC 17. This is our tax bill. We've kind of all been through this before. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on the tax bill? Income tax? LC 17?
Sure. For clarification, this was in the committee yesterday, I believe. I don't think it's been distributed tonight. It hasn't been introduced either, for that matter.
So, Paul, if you're coming, bring a lot of copies.
I should say it hasn't been read for the first time.
We'll take a short recess until we can get Big Gates to Paul up here. We'll recess. LC 17. For the benefit of those that were not here yesterday, Patricia Smith. Patricia here? Okay. Paul, you don't have to say anything. All right. For the benefit of everyone else who wasn't here yesterday, Paul, I'll give a recap of LC 17.
Mr. Chair, what LC 17 does is impose an increase in the personal income tax rate for a three-year period, starting with the 2002 tax year through the 2005 tax year, or through the 2004 tax year, and then it's sunsetted on January 1, 2005. The measure does not have any effect on the lowest bracket, 5% of taxable income up to $2,000 for $2,000 to $5,000 for single filers. It goes from 7 to 7.3, and then for over 5,000, it goes to 9.6%. One thing I'll point out to the committee, these numbers in here, the brackets, are adjusted annually for the inflation rate. So these are not the actual brackets you see now. They're actually about 6,300 or so for the top bracket for the single filer. That's basically what the measure does, and in fact, that is what the measure does, and then it's referred to the ballot for the next general election in November, the final section. Also passed out last night for material was a revenue impact. So this particular measure we estimate would generate $395 million in revenue L103. This is a collecting O2 tax liability, which would be collected when returns are filed in the spring of '03. But it also has a portion of the '03 tax year, based on the assumption that the withholding tables would be changed by the Department of Revenue, and quarterly payments would be adjusted by taxpayers in the first 6 months of the calendar year and the last 6 months of the biennium. It also has, because it's 3 years, it would run through the 2004 tax year. It would generate, we estimate, about $497 million in revenue in 0305. These numbers are calibrated to the September revenue forecast. Also included in your packet was a table showing our estimated distribution of the tax burden. I went through our estimation process. You can see that we estimate once federal tax offsets are accounted for, about $150 increase in 2002 tax year for the average taxpayer. Keep in mind that the average taxpayer, there's a wide variation in taxpayers and the amount that's paid, and you can see in that table the details. Now, we also included the personal income tax brackets and how they've changed historically, and you can see that the impact of indexing the brackets beginning in 1993 tax year, and those brackets are now, as I said, roughly about $6,300 for single filer to go into the top bracket and double that for joint filers.
Any other questions for Paul?
Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hold on, three tests for today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basic question, I guess the kind of question that maybe a first-time Revenue Committee member would ask, but that's my situation right now. When taxes are received from the state, if they're like in withholding, is it considered in the fiscal year that they're received is the fiscal year they're attributed to? Like, is it the state really on a cash basis in terms of, and these are estimations of what will be received in terms of withholding?
Early
payments and everything else.
What we do, and this is also done in the revenue forecast process, first thing we do is we estimate liability by tax year, because that's what's most closely tied to economic activity, which is the key link with the forecast. But once that liability is changed, then we make an estimate of how that affects the different types of payments, whether it's, if it's wage income, for example, do the folding, and it's almost an immediate effect with no lag. That's really what you're getting in that first 6 months, is the labor income. Other types of income that tend to come in payments of quarterly payments or final payments at the end of the year, we assume a longer lag. So what we've done with this measure, because it's a general measure, we've used our standard lag assumption for converting from a liability basis to a fiscal year collection basis. On your question about how we account for revenue in the general fund, it's all on a cash basis with one exception. We do include the first 30 days of withholding receipts in July at the end of a fiscal year that can be attributed as a liability back to the prior June. And that adjustment goes back to 1982 when a committee similar to this one was dealing with similar problems. That's the only non-cash, that's the only accrual adjustment that we make with the revenue stream. It's all on a cash basis. So it does have an impact. For example, investment income, we would assume would have a longer lag time between liability and collection.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Federer.
Thank you. Just for the benefit of those in here who have been here yesterday, and who have the tax measure summary, pointing out there's an error in the tax measure summary in the chart of taxable income brackets, where it shows single filers at the bottom above $12,900 falling into the 9% bracket. That actually would be $6,450 falling into the 9% bracket. And also, I think for anyone who wasn't here yesterday and hasn't been following the progress of discussions today, to point out, too, that I think we anticipate seeing some amendments to this as soon as this bill gets back to us in its introduced form. So, a word to the wise for anyone who will be here for the first time.
Mr. Chair, we are working on an amendment that would deal with issues on, for example, on penalties for being under withheld, recognizing that, that the 2002 tax year decisions were made based on a different thing.
Any further questions for Paul from the committee? Does anyone in attendance have a question for staff?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Castagna representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. The question I have is a follow-up to the testimony that I provided on Saturday, in which the Oregon Catholic Conference, and I know when we had an ecumenical meeting with the governor, this issue was raised. And the issue is what it would do to the rates if you exempted people below $50,000 total income from any sort of an income tax increase, such that lower-income people are protected, and that the increase then would impact middle-income and upper-income taxpayers. What that does, in effect, particularly if the legislature either refers the issue to the ballot or it is a referendum to the ballot, because a referendum petition has taken out exempting those below $50,000 total income, exempts essentially 1.1 million of Oregon's 1.6 million tax filers.
Let's say that again, Bob.
If you exempt those below $50,000
right.
total income, you have essentially exempted 1.1 million out of the 1.6 million approximately total returns in the state of Oregon. And we would suggest that that increases both the political feasibility and the viability of such a potential vote by the people of the state of Oregon by exempting those below $50,000 in total income. And it accomplishes, from the religious community's perspective, a tax equity issue and adds to that issue the political feasibility and viability of the measure. And the question then becomes is what does that do to those above $50,000? It's a total of approximately, we went over it this morning, I met with Elizabeth Martin Maher in the Legislative Revenue Office. You're talking about 70 million of the 277 million, or almost 25% of the potential increased tax, is contained within that under 50,000 total income category. So almost 25% of the increased tax is borne by that $1.1 million number, 1.1 million tax filers. They're bearing about 25% of the increased tax burden.
Okay. I was asking you if you were done.
I'm done. I'm for the
representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know he's posed a question to staff, and I don't know whether or not staff has the calculation concluded, because I have another question in the same vein, but I don't want to interrupt your answer.
I think we've answered the question on the revenue side, right?
What does it do to the rate?
What does it do in terms...
If you exempt those below $50,000 total income, but you want to keep
the same amount of revenue,
what does that do to the rate to accomplish the same revenue inflow to the state while exempting those below $50,000 total income?
We can certainly address that. We can make a run and see what that looks like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Castagna, you raised two very interesting policy questions. You talked about a move to increase the political feasibility and viability, and you also raised the question of the tax equity issue. What is the absence of an income tax in this? What's your reaction to the absence of an income tax? with reference to political feasibility and viability and tax equity.
Corporate agent tax?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I discussed that issue on Saturday as well in terms of the shift that's occurred since the passage of Measure Number 5 when we were previously at an equal corporate income tax, personal income tax inflow to the state, and that shift since 1990. I think that's an equity issue that is also amongst the mix of questions and issues. But we've also provided a number of you with some information on unemployment insurance benefits expiring for a good number of people, starting now, increasing in October, and taking a dramatic increase in December. And we would also ask that that issue be on the table. And if you were to extend unemployment insurance benefits, the Employment Department has indicated that would occasion an unemployment insurance tax rate increase in the year 2004. And I don't know what that percentage is or what that number is for the business community, but I think that should also be taken into consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another way maybe to look at that, and that would be that less than one-third of the people will actually bear three-quarters of the liability for the increase in taxes. And while I can see some reason to exempt or to not have any impact on truly low-income Oregonians, a single person making $45,000 a year, I would doubt that it classifies as low-income.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I mean, we're looking at ability to pay and that equity. I think if we look at where the poverty level is, I mean, sure, a single person earning maybe $40,000 to $45,000 a year, gross income, might be able to contribute something. I think if we look at the cost of housing, cost of food, average cost today. I mean, we're just looking for a break-even point. And one of the issues that we took into consideration, although you have deferred or delayed the impact, was the impact of Measure 88, in which eventually 80% of the benefits of Measure 88 flow to those above $50,000 in taxable income.
Who probably pay 80% of the tax. Thank you.
Yeah.
I just wanted to remind the committee that remember the brackets for joint filing are double percentile filing.
Yeah.
So if you have that the issue of $50,000, we would normally think of as that joint or single filing.
Sure.
So that makes that where you then that would automatically under current law would be $25,000 for single.
For the single person. Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, just keep a big picture in mind, too. We do have the refundable earned income tax credit coming into effect in 2003 to address tax relief to low-income working families as well. So that's got to be kept in context of the big picture as well.
Any other questions? Bob, your staff, any questions for Bob?
Mr. Chair, I don't think the question was actually answered, but we're going to do it later. In that calculation, Paul, could you also put in, if it was a surtax on the corpus, as we discussed, I think it was 5%, certainly not 5%, but 5% surtax, how that would affect the rate so that was part of the package? Mm-hmm. Cut them off to 6,000 and is the other part. Just to look to the
person base, we're actually in the process of putting together a menu for you so you can see what the marginal effects would be in different proportional increases in the corporate rate. So we'll have that for you.
Just one last comment, too. Much as I agree with being as fair as we can and place the burden on those people who have probably gained the most in the last 10 years, we should keep in mind that even at the 50,000 level, we're talking about $12 or $13 a month in extra taxes for an individual. I mean, it's money, but you just kind of get that small amount of money for a tax increase, you wonder how much of the ethical and arguments you still have left. I mean, most people make $50,000 a year to maintain the school system, maintain the state patrol, maintain your
public health system and all the other programs you talk about, I think it's pay $10, $12, $13 a month, even at that income level.
Madam Chair. It is interesting, Bob, the equity issue when you talk about the corporate tax as opposed to the PIT, the personal income tax. I think you can make the argument that's not so much an issue of equity between businesses and individuals as it is between businesses and businesses, because you know the bulk of our filers now, business filers, are pass-through entities, partnerships, LLCs, sole proprietorships, what have you, that will be paying the increase if this passes on their personal income tax returns. And so it really becomes a question of equity among business filers, and not so much an issue of equity between business and individual. That commends discussion, I think, of the corporate income tax as part of this piece, if we're going out with it.
Good question. Paul, for the benefit of those of us that haven't done much work in the revenue area, can you outline what is available in terms of relief for low-income filers? What are the programs that are on?
First, good morning. I think one of the key issues when you look at income filers for the personal income tax is when, with the threshold level, so that's when your income becomes taxable. And the two key things that affect that is the amount of the standard deduction you're allowed. And the second component, and the way it works in Oregon, is what we call the personal exemption credit, which is basically a credit you get for yourself or your spouse and your descendants. So it's just like the federal exemption, only in Oregon we treat it as a credit. Those are the two key elements that are available for everybody. There are a number of other programs we have. We have tied into the federal earned income tax credit, allowing 5% of the federal credit. We have not made that refundable. By something being refundable, we mean that the credit can exceed your total liability. So you actually receive a refund in excess of what your initial withholding was. Representative Cheverly's comments on the working family credit, that was made refundable by the 01 legislature. That's effective in the 03 tax year, and that is a program that would be available to those with dependent family care expenses, and that credit could now exceed what their tax liability would be. So it's actually refundable now. So those are the major elements available to low-income individuals. One of the things that's done quite frequently by national organizations is to compare states as to where the threshold is in terms of when your income becomes taxable for low-income people. Oregon does tend to have a relatively low threshold. My recollection is around 10th to 15th among the states, depending on what level of income is used. But keep in mind also, of course, that Oregon does not have a consumption tax base, which is most states do have, and does have a significant impact in many cases on low-income individuals.
Further questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one thing I would point out to you, when you look at the taxable income tables, because Oregon's highest rate comes in at a relatively low income level, and what is it, according to the chart I see here, joint filer pays the maximum rate after $12,200 taxable income. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, for all intents and purposes, if somebody is working, is a flat tax, so that there's really no moderation as to when you kick in at the highest level. So that an exemption for a joint return of an exemption below $50,000 will really take care of the low-income people. One of the reasons we moved requesting the state for the refundable earned income tax credit was because of Oregon's reputation in the state income tax chart of taxing those who have incomes below the poverty level. And that was why we moved in that direction. The 1986 federal tax reform, and the Revenue Office prepared the reports on this, the 1986 federal tax reform attempted to exempt from federal income tax liability families below income, if families below the poverty level. If they were below poverty, they were by definition poor and therefore going to be exempt by federal policy from having a federal income tax obligation. We don't have a federal consumption tax. We don't have a state consumption tax, but we are taxing those in Oregon via the state income tax, those people whose incomes are below poverty. So that was one of the reasons we attempted to move to the refundable earned income tax credit. We've been successful to get 5% of the federal earned income tax credit on a non-refundable basis to be part of the Oregon income tax code. We have not yet been able to step up to a state refundable earned income tax credit.
Other comments or questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone out there that wishes to come forward and testify or discuss LC 17? Now, I don't want you all rushing up there at once. Are there any further comments on the part of the committee or questions for Mr. Warner? Then I will close the public hearing on LC 17. And bearing in mind that we have a hallway moment going on, I will reset the committee hearing and
restoration. We were discussing LC 17 in the interest of not necessarily time, but expediency in moving deadlines. I think it's wise that we come up with a consensus of this committee as to what, even though we cannot amend, but a consensus of this committee for our drafters as to what we think the components of the tax bill ought to be. The speaker has very graciously given us wide latitude in determining what the will of this committee is. So without further ado, let me open it up to comments, questions. What's anyone's dream and technical thought ideal structure for this referral? Or are we totally happy with the way it is? Representative Johnson.
I'll start for the sake of getting the discussion moved. One of the sticking points that we have wrestled with was in the negotiation committee, and I think in our respective caucuses, is whether there is a corporate component or there is not a corporate component. And I think that remains unresolved at this point. I think a case could be made to say that if we are reaching into all of the tax brackets, because as Oregonians, we are all in a fiscal crisis, then an equity argument can be mounted to include a corporate component.
Mr. Chairman, I would say at the same time that one of the items that has been brought up here earlier in discussion is an item that has not received broad discussion. In terms of my caucus, and that is the differences in terms of as an equity issue business to business versus business to individual. I think that's an interesting discussion because it's something that hasn't been discussed in great detail. And Representative Shetterly brought that forward.
Comments?
No, I was just, Paul, do you know offhand what the proportion of business income, I'm not sure how to phrase the question at this hour, but the share of business income that's actually reflected in your personal income tax returns through your pass-through entity?
We've estimated that at around 12%. It tends to vary between about 10 and 14%. So
is that, I'm sorry.
That would be 12% of total personal income tax collections are really proprietor income. Pass-through, S-corp income. There's something that would be defined as business income.
That's true.
So, just so I make sure I understand what Paul's saying, that's approximately then 85% of the business-generated revenue is reflected on the corporate returns.
Mm.
Is that?
No, what I'm saying is that of the personal income tax, which is much bigger than the corporate in terms of collections, about $4 billion, about 10% of that, or about 12% of that, is actually business income, that revenue.
Okay.
So that would be in the neighborhood of $450 million. Some business income as comes in the form of personal income tax collection.
Mr. Chair. And Paul, then what is the amount collected through corporate income tax?
The amount collected in the corporate income tax has dropped significantly, 40%. I don't have my... It dropped about 45% last year. As I recall, the forecast for the current fiscal year would be about $285 million. But that is... it actually dropped a little bit below 200. That would be the forecast for the 2002-03 fiscal year. In the 2001-02 fiscal year, I believe it dropped below 200. But again, that's a 47% drop from the prior year. So it had gotten up to as high as 400 million.
That's true. That's the information on the revenue. I guess in terms of the number of filers, how do they compare between business filers through the personal income tax and corporate filers?
In terms of numbers?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a printout on that, but I do not have it with me. But there are a very large number of corporate filers who do not pay any income tax. And a very high percentage of those corporate income tax collections come from a relatively small number of filers. And we will have that hopefully listed listening to us, and we'll bring up that table from the Department of Revenue that shows the distribution of the corporate income tax by a filer income class.
Paul, just to make sure I got my figures correct, I think we saw a figure one time of the 5% surtax. And you consider all the averaging involved in this and the fact that some corporations are not profitable, time they're going to average some of that stuff forward, that we were looking at a bump of about $14 million in the tax. We're really talking about an equity issue more than huge amounts of money coming in. It would take the total tax up to about $407 million. Is that correct? That's what we're looking
for. Yeah, our estimate was about $12 million on a 5%. Increase in the corporate rate, and the corporate rate is 6.6, so that would bump the rate to about 6.93, and our estimate was just based on what the forecast is for collections, so that would be about 12 million. It's actually our estimate for what 2002 liability is, and we're assuming that, you know, that's based because of the lag in the corporate collection declaration. Basically, what you do is get 1 year in corporate revenue rather than a year plus as you would in the first 20%.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In terms of doing this for the work tomorrow, and you've done the estimates on personal income tax in regard to what the net impact would be on an individual relative to also the federal taxes, could you do the same for corporations? Because obviously, is there going to be a reduction in the federal excise corporate tax because of the increased state taxes? And that would be an open question if there would be.
Representative Devlin, I think it is important to remember that you know, corporate taxpayers, their tax burden varies widely from year to year because of their profitability.
Right.
And you can have very large corporations that don't pay any corporate income tax and they have no net income. One of the issues we are concerned about is corporations' ability to carry losses forward, which means that may have a significant effect on the next couple of years in terms of what collections will be, both the federal level and the state level. But in terms of federal deductibility, a corporation can deduct their state and corporate income taxes, and most corporations are going to be paying a 34% rate. So from a corporation standpoint, they get a 34 cent reduction for every dollar they pay in state tax.
So there's some offset.
Yeah.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Warner, given that what is ultimately going to pull us out of the economic recession we're in is getting people back to work, and that business on all levels, not just corporations, but all of the other types of proprietorships and the escorts and all the other things, are going to be the ones that end up hiring most of the people, is there any way that it would be possible to gauge the impact on a recovery or on the ability of businesses to grow and hire more people by increasing the tax rates?
Firstly, Martin, we do have a model that allows us to look at the feedback effects from changes in tax law, and we do, as the economic theory would suggest, we do see a negative relationship between job growth, income growth, and rate of taxes. I would emphasize, however, that that model is a long-term model, and in our view, most of the state tax policy decisions you make will be long-term in nature. There's not a lot that a state can do in the short term to influence the recovery. It's largely a federal policy that will have the biggest effect. Of course, you can do things that have a negative effect, but in terms of overall broad tax changes or broad spending changes, you have to look at the impact of a tax increase versus the impact of a expenditure decrease. And that's where your costs and benefits come in. In terms of general economic activity, they're not significantly different in the short term. In the longer term, the tax policy is important because it influences the rate of return for capital and for labor in Oregon. And Oregon operates in an open economy where we're trying to attract resources to come in. That's where tax policy is most important at the state level, is in the long term. Unfortunately, in a recession, the biggest factor influencing us is the national recovery, whether that materializes or not.
Now, that's in wisdom, or at least some of the equity and pass through. Those words are not lost on me. I suppose I have some reservations on the corporate side of this. I remember when this body passed out the cigarette tax, and my local paper blasted me for the aggressive nature of that tax. But they failed to mention any phase in of 88 and some of their stuff we did. But that's so bright. But this almost strikes me as the opposite side of that coin. We have already in this bill a progressive rate structure where the higher income folks are paying a higher rate, and then those are the folks that are usually working for the profitable corporations that, you know, are paying those salaries. And so I think that's a little bit of a double whammy on those folks. I mean, those with the most ability to pay, I understand that. But where I think we really need to drive this thing to is the most fair structure we can possibly produce. And I'm concerned about that. I'm not necessarily saying if the corporate's in there, it's not fair, but it's got to be made as fair as possible. And that's my concern about corporate tax. Any other discussion? Any feelings? Show of hands, any other?
Mr. Chair, I know that the speaker wanted to get a sense of what the committee was feeling. There may be some people in the audience who have some thoughts that might be instructive. I don't know whether it's useful to have a public testimony on this specific issue. This is the most specificity that we've discussed regarding the bill.
Sure.
I cannot speak for my caucus, so I'll speak for myself. The figure we're looking at here, I think I'm out as fair as you can get it when you add the corporate sewer tax in. I support Representative Shuttle in that. We can discuss this all night long, and we'll never come to the conclusion of whether we should cut it off 50,000 or we should change 7.3 to 7.1 or 7.35 or whatever. I think it's about as fair as we can get at this point, and I would think the package we put together here as far as financials concern is probably where we want to be. There's no perfect way to do this thing. We should expect an amendment to come back on the corporate side But other than that, I would think it's as good as we're going to do. And I think it's something that's reasonable to do.
It is my read of this committee in listening to commentary that the consensus of this committee is to put in the corporate tax that it's been quoted on. Is that the consensus? May I assume so?
Sure. As a matter of equity among business taxpayers, I would support that. I would. You take two businesses side by side, one's an LLC and one is a C Corp, and you're drawing a distinction based just on the tax classification of that business entity. Otherwise, you've got the LLC with the pass-through tax liability going on to the individual's personal income tax return, and you're not having a corresponding effect on the C Corporation. So, to me, the equity issue is really more a matter of equity among business taxpayers than the committee's consideration of the C Corp.
Representative Hayden.
Mr. Chairman, is it the sense that this would be a revenue neutral thing and that the personal income, the net revenue from personal income taxes would be reduced and backfilled by corporate taxes?
I think that's a fair question. I think it's been discussed both ways. I don't think we're talking about enough money in terms of the overall tax package. I mean, we're at 395, so you can keep it at 395 or you can go to 407.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you can go to 381 plus 14.
Of course, we could discuss lowering the overall rate to, you know, 2, 3, and 4%. Do you have any revenue impact on those, Paul?
No, Mr. Chairman. You have a revenue impact on going from the 7.3 to 7.2, keeping everything else the same, would be about 19 million. And your bill currently has a 5.7396. If you were to change that to 5.7296, it would be 376 instead of 395. So that's a 19 difference. So that's not quite really neutral, but of course. And of course, you can adjust these rates any way that you want to go.
My problem may be in giving a definitive answer. I mean, separately, I think there is an equity issue in including the corporate tax as to whether that would be in addition to the LC-17 and that be the only change, or whether you back out some of this either through a change in the lower rates or simply across the board reduction in the rates. I'm not sure what the target is, so it's hard for me to say whether it'll be this plus the corporate or back. I'm not sure how this corresponds to where we're going in the bond piece and the other components of where they go. So that's hard for me to make a commitment on this evening as we sit here. But certainly in concept, should we include a corporate element of this? In concept, I would say yes, we should, but I can't say today that as a standard, that it should be 13 or 14 in addition to the revenue we get from LC-17. I just don't know what the target is.
And in concept, that would be a revenue neutral?
I'm not anxious to make the tax increase any higher than it needs to be, so yeah. That'd be.
And in concept, is this revenue neutral to you guys? Or you want to?
Not necessarily, Mr. Chair, from my point of view. We're looking at a hydraulic here between bonding and this. And cut, and we know how hard it is to find those cuts also. And remember also that the amount of money we're asking, even from the 7.2 to 7.3 people, when you get down to, you're talking $8, $9, $10, $12 a month again on individuals. I know it's maybe a lot of money to some people, but for the people in the tax practice we're looking at, I think we have to remind ourselves we're not asking a lot on a monthly or yearly basis. I can understand Representative Hayden's feelings about making it tax neutral, and he's got a good point. But I'm worried about the bigger picture a little bit, too. And every time we cut something off one side, it pops up somewhere else. You've got to balance this thing out.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the purposes of discussion and just for purposes of... if you had the figure from 7.3 to 7.2, when you go from 9.6 to 9.5, how much do you lose? I know it's going to be a very large figure.
For each tenth of a percent on the top rate, keeping everything else the same, is about $60 million.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's not tax neutral. Okay. So
you do the math.
Seven
three five to 7.2 is $19 million. And 9.6 to 9.5 is $60 million.
Yeah, I'm always trying to kick Cravens out of the room. Has he left?
Yeah.
Any comments you want to make with regard to corporate taxes? Or would you just sit back there
in general and
talk with Lindsay? You want to be safe or you want to be sorry?
Not really, yeah.
Hey, we are having a public hearing on a very serious matter.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven, American Electronics Association. It's very difficult to react to an individual piece of a pie. It's very difficult to say, what about 7.3 versus 7.2? You know, I think what a lot of the business community has been trying to say all year, and not with criticism at all, is it's difficult to react to anything other than the big picture. And I think that's what you're all been wrestling with the last 9 days, too, is what's the whole picture so I can react. I'm not reacting to an individual piece or an element or a decimal point. You know, what's the whole big picture? So I think it's the corporate tax surcharge is, a relatively new concept, at least in the general broad public discussions of the last 24 hours or so. I, quite frankly, haven't had time to go survey my 185 member companies and ask for a consensus opinion on it. I know what the reaction would be is in what context, and I think that's what you all are wrestling with, is what's the context, what's the bombing, what's the cuts, what's the buyback, what do we see? When all is said and done, what's the state of Oregon going to look like? And so those are my comments. I guess my only other comment is, I forget who raised this issue, of the real way we raise revenue for the state is to encourage the creation of high-wage jobs. I mean, given, unless we throw out the total tax system we have and come up with something radically different, we are relying upon personal income tax is for the vast bulk of all the revenues we get. And I can do a paid political announcement for the high-tech community that I represent. It's pretty easy to remember, roughly 75,000 jobs with an average salary of $75,000 a year. That's where we're given at the office. We're given at the office by generating and maintaining high-wage jobs, because those high-wage jobs are the backbone of your revenue system for the state. And if somebody says business isn't paying if we don't do a corporate tax surcharge, you know, I would say that the businesses that are hiring people and paying them family-wage jobs are paying. They're paying by paying those salaries upon which our whole revenue thing rests. So that's my comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for those enlightening remarks.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair.
Is it Joe? Enter and sign in, please.
Thank you.
Nope, wait. Sign out.
Pay attention. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if you'd allow me a remedial question as Mr. President's look away to put
Joe just did this.
Having a consultation with my colleagues.
Pay attention to the witnesses, not these guys you can see in the hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given that you have unavoidably become part of the face of the business community tonight, there's one other aspect of the bill that I was curious if you had a reaction to. Some of your other business colleagues have weighed in on the question of a referral or a straight-up vote, the referral contained in the last section of LP 17. The Oregon Business Association has indicated that they would support a corporate tax increase, but only if it were voted on by the legislature. Do you have any thought about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, you said who has supported that?
Oregon Business Association.
Oh. That they would, I guess, I cannot speak for the Oregon Business Association. We haven't developed, I don't have a clear consensus policy from my association on the issue of referral or not referral. So I would not want to hazard a guess at this point.
Well, their support of the increase hinges on that point. So that would be something you might want to crunch your numbers
about. Let me remind the committee that we are discussing ideas for LC 17, which is a referral. So I would like to ask you, at least in the time being, to keep your comments relative to this measure. We're trying to make this measure better, not discuss something that isn't even before us. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, you're going to slap my hand.
Mr. Craven,
if that's okay.
I am very happy to exercise the gracious will of the Speaker to discuss this bill and make it as good as it possibly can be. I'm not here to debate referral versus straight up.
My question isn't about referral.
Thank you.
But it's, Mr. Craven,
I won't slap your hand for anything else.
You might. Mr. Craven, the net impact of this, or the gross impact, would be about $12 million statewide, about $8 million net when you take into consideration the offset from decreased federal income taxes. Here's where you're going to slap my hand. If we didn't have these $2 million in cuts to the Oregon University system, would your association be more inclined to support this? And of that, I think about 1.1 is reduced unspent engineering funding above a certain level.
That's a fair question. I like that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dunlin, I noticed that myself in the vastly copied, purloined version of the budget cut list that is circulated among this room. I don't know that that is even something that has been presented. I don't see a bill with those cuts in it. I see a piece of paper that people have copied. That's, I guess, the point of the big picture. To say, at the end of the day, we raise your employees' taxes, we raise your business taxes, and we whack the part of state government that you care deeply about, probably isn't the kind of holistic picture that I bring back with lots of applause.
That's a fair question. Any other questions for Mr. Craven before we've got him here? Okay, you're officially dismissed.
Thank you, Mr.
You know, no double jeopardy. You did your time. Thank you, Jim. Joe?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhardt, Associate Oregon Industries. And I know the hour is late, and maybe that's what's fogging everybody's thinking here. I'm sitting here looking at Oregon's in a deep recession. We've got the highest unemployment. We've had 175,000 layoffs. Small business creates about 75% of the new jobs. Oregon wealth is moving out of the state. Taxation, by all people you talk to, is the major deterrent for business growth. The voters oppose raising taxes. Corporate and personal income taxes have dropped over 50%. Oregon bankruptcies are up 20%. And here we are talking about raising one, corporate taxes, two, taking more money out of the consumer's hands. I just don't understand where this is going to help our overall recovery. And like Jim said, revenue for the state comes from income taxes. And we need to promote an economic program that will promote new income taxes. I think business has suffered. Business is trying to work out of a recession, a deep recession. I think our December forecast is not going to be good either when it comes in. I think we're taking a step maybe in the wrong direction here. Trying to go after, it's like in the country they say it's like eating the seed corn. You got to protect what makes you grow. And I think we need to consider that.
we left out one condition, maybe the most important, in your litany of still avoiding.
Yes.
We also have the lowest job creation rate in the nation.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think many of us share the concern that you've raised. We also have a $482 million problem. Schools are closing. We are risking cutting patrol officers. We're risking putting developmentally disabled people out onto the street. Help me fix our problem absent the taxes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I don't think you have an easy task before you.
That part I know, Joe.
And
Now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah.
I want to keep, make sure you understand where you are.
That is easy.
I think you need to understand that we have some proposals about more bonding. I think that we should support. I think that we've got more cuts that possibly could be had. I think you need to look more directly to those two areas for possibilities of more revenue. You know, like I said, it's not easy. All of us are out here struggling with where we should go and what direction we should all be in. But I think when you look at what you're trying to do here and what you're talking about is trying to cut back in an area where we need to move forward. I mean, and if I had a simple answer, I'd tell you, but I don't.
Mr. Chair. You represent a business organization, and I think every business textbook in the world would say it is bad policy to use long-term debt to finance present operations. Reconcile AOI's recommendation that more bonding is a good thing with that premise.
It's Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think when you look at bonding, you're borrowing money. When you look at a surcharge, you're borrowing money out of the economy. And when you get down the road 3 years from now, you're still going to owe money back. You're going to be giving money back. I think you've got to look at where do you go at that point? What happens when the surcharge ends? Well, we lost that income. Does that mean we should make that more of a permanent tax? I don't think so.
Representative
Bates. Madam Chair, thank you. Place off of Taylor a philosophy that many people adhere to, and to a degree I adhere to also. But I would like to make a few other points that may have been overlooked. Oregon has fallen from 25th in the nation in overall taxes to 47th against income in the last 10 years. Government does have a role to play in business, infrastructure maintenance, safety, an education system without which we don't have any kind of a chance for having reasonable business in this state. When you ask people why you come to the state or why you not go to the state, very rarely do you talk about tax structure. You talk about schools, talk about roads, talk about livability more than anything else. You know, I've been very active, as you probably are aware, of trying to bring new businesses into the urban area in Medford. Those are the questions we get asked about, not the tax system. The biggest one being schools, frankly. If you haven't got a good school system, K-12 and higher ed, people are interested in coming in, and if we don't maintain those services, no matter what else we do here, it's going to be a problem for business. And that's something we sometimes, I think, lose sight of, especially in the short run like this. Having said that, I will also say to you that what comes out of this body is going to have to be a compromise between your views and those views of other people in this room. It'll be a compromise, hopefully, of both bonding, which is borrowing, which is most people know how I feel about that. Representative Johnson has expressed it well for me. New revenue and some cuts. And that's where we need to go. So I don't think asking us to say, where are you on the planet right now, is quite the approach I would like to see you take. I would rather say, have you say to us, we understand the difficulty you have. We have to look at all those three areas and come up with some kind of a balance that will really work. And that's where we're trying to go.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I understand what you're saying. I think it's important to understand also that one of the reasons people move to Oregon is because there is a good economy, because we do have some spend for good schools. But the backbone of that is still our income tax. And that's what's down. Our capital gains are down. Business is down. Consumer Commerce is there. And there has to be that formula that has to work. And I agree with you.
Thank you.
Representative Shepard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe, I sympathize. I'm a taxpayer, although I've seized upon a good tax cutting strategy, and that is individuals join the legislature and tax liability goes way down concomitant with your income. I don't disagree, I'm very sympathetic. But you know, again, getting to real results and timely results, there's been a lot of brave talk in this building for the last week and even leading up to that about cuts. I've watched members of this group slave over that list, and I've seen others who came in promising their own $500 million cut list struggle to get to 70 or 80 before they run out of steam. And we are facing a situation where, like it or not, as a result of the latest revenue forecast, we've got a governor who says, you get this fixed or I'm going to implement the cuts, and those cuts will result in the release of 3,950 prisoners onto our streets, the closing of youth authority facilities, the termination of programs for the developmentally disabled and seniors. And I guess, sympathetic to the impact of taxes on an economy, Joe, I don't see that as being an environment that promotes economic growth and job development either. I mean, we are at a point here of a choice of evils and balancing all of the miserable options before us. This is the fifth session that we are talking about taxes here. It is not the first session, not the second, third, fourth. We are down to the bottom of the barrel in options that each one of us probably would have considered untenable and unthinkable in July and August are facing us squarely because we're running out of those options. And, again, I'm not the Ways and Means guy. I've not been down there slugging through the cuts, but I hear horror stories of those that are, and those are serious cutters. And we've got to come up with a solution here fast. And again, I think that the consequence of some of the impacts of the cuts the governor is threatening to implement have every bit as negative a prospect for us in business growth and job development. I forgot to mention the shortened school year and the impression that creates nationally about Oregon as a place to move, to locate a business. We are balancing a choice of pretty awful solutions here, but I think that's why the real answer is in a balance of those things so that we don't do too much harm on the tax side, we don't do too much harm on the cut side, but realistically, I think that's about the best place we're going to get. And let me say this. We're not going to raise the tax. We're going to ask the voters if they are willing to support the tax. And I think that's entirely a defensible thing to do, recognizing then that the voters will have to take ownership for the consequences. And the next legislative session, we'll take the answer. We'll take whatever answer they give us. But, boy, this is hard.
Representative Hayden.
I appreciate you stepping forward to testify, and I was interested in your comparison of borrowing from the economy. That's very strong language. I like that. It describes it very well. You borrow from the purchasing power of the people, you borrow from their household budgets, and in some way that has to be paid back. There's no free lunch. As it happens, Oregon is not heavily bonded. We do not have a lot of bonded indebtedness. We have a substantial opportunity to do more bonding, and you said that would be your preference. Have you given any thought to where you would bond, what revenue streams you would use?
Well, I think Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, I think this speaker came up with a pretty good plan initially when session started. I think we supported that plan. I think there's other avenues, I'm sure. But there's a variety of ways. And we are looking short term and we are looking long term. And when I look long term, I worry because I want Oregon to bounce back. And we're taking so much money and we've already taken Measure 88 pretty much out of the economy. I start to worry about that long-term problem, about businesses leaving, about business not being able to grow and about taking money out of the consumer and having a tough time. And that's for everybody in a certain area. So I'm sure there's other areas out there, but I'll pay them in a
second. Thank you.
Any other questions for Joe?
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for not bringing that Harvey Matthews fellow in.
No respect.
Hey, at least he's awake.
I heard his name.
Does anyone else want to testify on Harvey?
The corporate piece here.
Same thing you want, but I hope you got some good comments on corporate.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Kennedy, I'm Ozzie Rose, Confederation of Oregon School Ministers. I was going to start my remarks with, I know you don't customarily expect me to talk about what you're talking about, but the schools are a major employer, a major business in every community in our state. And the issue, I understand the issue of money and economy, and we got to have jobs and so forth. But that cut two ways in the recession. And Mr. Warner suggested to you that we get out of the recession because of long-term federal stuff, not what we're going to be able to do here. And so I don't want us to overreact to the issue of we're going to get us out of the recession, when at the same time, the kind of cuts that we're talking about on the school side, in some of our counties, in our smaller counties, 12 to 15% of the payroll is out of the school. And the kind of cuts that we have on the table are going to be cuts in people. And I don't want to whine. You know these numbers. But from the $5.2 billion that we started the biennium with and built budgets on, we lost $150 million of it before we started having special sessions. And we're still now in the second week of the second year of school, and we still have $400 million in play that we don't know about for this year. That's the $150 that we're voting on next week, the $50 that was in the bonds that got vetoed, and about $200 in our share of cuts. I already put those numbers together. But the 5.2, that's still out there. And that's all. The cuts are going to have to be such at this point in time, that would be mostly people and shorter school years. And shorter school years mean less payroll. The only way you save money by cutting your school year is to lay off people and not pay them. All of that talk about our economies and in our local communities, a big hunk of it's going to fall out with the kind of cuts that are at risk for us in this situation. I think it parallels out in some other public tech service, but I have relatively good data about how it will impact if we don't make some of these. And I believe you're on the right track with this, a mix of taxes, cuts, and funding. But you need to balance that so it works in the long term. And whatever we bond for, we're back here. It's only, 175 days? So we're here trying to balance the next budget. And to the extent that we've bonded, that's a problem in balancing the next budget. So I encourage you to support this. And I think if you move toward the extra $12 million that's available in the corporate, I wouldn't make it revenue neutral. I'd add it to the package, and I'd look at things like the engineering school and other things that you can do with that money.
Sure. I'll be done with
this. One of the things I'm concerned about is, and we're not sure of the whole package yet, so it's a tough question to ask, but I'm going to ask you, I'm a preamble the question and ask the question. The preamble is this. This is going to be going out, as it looks like, as a referral that may or may not get the November ballot, that may or may not get the voter's pamphlet as a supplement. We've already missed the voter's pamphlet for sure on this, but we may have to put out a supplement which people may not read as carefully as a pamphlet. If this were to apply to schools, about half of this would go against schools, another $200 million. There's also a chance they could go out straight up and end up as a referendum after the first year. There's lots of scenarios out there we're concerned about. Well, the question is this. What do you think the real impact
on K-12 educational debt. All this stuff fails. $200 million here, $150 in the endowment, $50 million we've lost. We're talking $400 million. What does that really look like to a high school student or someone in the fifth grade if we don't get these things done? Or a referral doesn't go out, or a referral fails, or the referendum goes out and fails.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, I believe that most school people have, most school districts have decided we're so late in the process, I can't do much more about cutting things now, and that it will mean shorter school years. And I think that if you got the worst case scenario, which I anticipate you won't, or if it were the worst case, then I think you're going to have what I call rolling shutdown. And the earliest shutdown will be sometime in mid-April, and some won't, those can go till maybe the 1st of June, early June, but you'll have a rolling closing of schools early, and those of you serving next year will have a good time with that event. But it's just kind of, you can't shut down and start up, so you've got to, you know, we're in the second year, and if you lay off good teachers now and then you happen to get the money in a month or 2 months, they're not there to get back. And so I think most everybody is kind of in the mode of, I'm going to run to kind of know what we've got, and then we will shorten the school year. And that varies, but that train of thought says we'll totally run out of money. And I had a discussion with the superintendent a week ago, had about 70 of them here in Salem, and most of the rest of them on detail around the state. And the term totally run out of money, run out of money is a subjective term because of local control and local conditions. And each community is going to have to talk about what does run out of money mean in this context. Does run out of money mean I can't write another check because it would bounce? Or does run out of money mean I'm shutting down everything except my seniors' required classes so they're eligible to get into college? Or does running out of money mean I'm shutting everything down, but we're going to save enough reserve to have a startup capacity next fall? Or run out of money, I'm going to keep some kind of a limited custodial staff to take care of my infrastructure. So the concept of run out of money, and how much do I have in reserve to do any of these variety of things that I just mentioned? Run out of money will be a different thing in each community, and local school boards in their community are going to have to decide what that means and then decide when we can shut down. And that's why I think it will be what I call a rolling shutdown.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any opinions on what's the best way to avoid the worst case scenario as far as tax brackets or as far as referral or referendum?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think I'm supposed to answer the question about referral, according to the chair's direction.
Hey, you can slap my hand, but you can't slap yours.
Well, but I got to get along with all of them. I'm just you.
You retired last year.
I know, Jim.
I'm happy to sit here, but I'm not going to discuss things that aren't in front of us.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm hungry. It's late. I'm tired. I've been doing this for 9 days just like everybody else. It can't respect the wishes of the chair. I'm just shut this dumb bitch down.
That's all the question.
What a mean guy. And I'd also like to encourage the committee to disregard everything the witness said, because he indicated that we have 175 days until we're back dealing with the next budget. Or maybe I should encourage the committee to believe that.
I'm sorry, I'm not used to working with those smaller numbers.
Yeah.
It is closer than I thought.
Yeah. Regrettably. Maybe a lot shorter. Hopefully not. Any other questions for Mr. Rose?
Thank you.
As always, I appreciate it. One of the things I see in here is the length of time of this tax. 3 years. I mean, we obviously came to a great consensus right away on corporate or not corporate. We've got 3 years in here. And I've argued this with probably most everyone on this committee. It's my opinion that we come here to solve Oregon's budget shortfall, not Oregon's revenue problem. And this coming from a guy who's got several proposals that many of you in the audience know about. And I'm concerned about this thing is 3 years in duration, that it may be more difficult to pass, and that it actually puts an onus over next session of getting anything fundamental done. Does the committee have any thoughts on this? Or 1 year, 2 year, 3 year? Well, where'd 3 years come from? I wasn't part of your discussions. Representative
Hayden. I've wondered that for the last 9 days, why we're talking, well, since we started talking about an income tax, why it would be 3 years and not 1 year, 6 months. Why not till July 31 of 2003?
I
mean, that's where the problem is. The problem is between now and July 31.
Look, Mr. Chair.
June 30.
Well, the problem we need to get through the biennium.
Yeah.
I don't know why 1 year doesn't solve that.
Yeah, I wondered that.
And we're here to balance the budget, not to put more revenue into the next biennium. That's the next assembly issue. I mean, that's one man's
thought. Well, just I think we need to work with whole numbers, since for income tax purposes, you've got primarily on the personal side. You've got a fiscal calendar year of taxpayers, and that goes through your tax your entities too, so I don't think it works technically to have a change in the tax rate in the middle of the tax year. So I think you're either looking at 1 year or 2 years. Paul, if you go with 1 year, then actually some drops out in this biennium, doesn't it? If you make it for only 2002, you would lose some in this biennium because of the estimated payments that would come in the first 6 months of the next year.
Is that correct, President Shelley? We assume that the withholding tables will be changed. So a portion of that 395 estimate is from the old 03 tax year.
Neither do I. Maybe that's why we're big on 1 year.
Okay. Well, the tax bill, or the draft that is written now, it applies to 2002 tax year, okay, and 2003 and 2004. Now, the way that we assume that will be collected is the 2002 liability is going to be reflect these rates that this passes and approved by voters. It will reflect these rates. Now, people haven't had their withholding changed, so the year is almost done, and we're assuming that very little will be collected, if anything. And most of that collection will come in the form of lower refunds or final payments on April 15th. So that will be how the 2002 increase will be reflected. It'll all come in the spring of 03. Now, there's another component that's part of the revenue forecast. That is the 03 rate increase. And the 03 rate increase assumes the withholding tables are adjusted to reflect these higher rates. So those 03 higher collections start coming in January of 03 because of the withholding tables. You start getting more withholding receipts in this biennium.
And April and June estimated payments.
Yeah. Okay. So what you're looking at here is it's not even quite a year and a half, but it's a year and about a third of tax payments. So we assume we're going to capture a third of the year in the first 6 months of the calendar year, which is the last 6 months of our current biennium.
Paul, could you
be part of 03?
Well, you had mentioned earlier this evening that, or someone mentioned, maybe this year, that in one situation, in July, at the end of the biennium, you return the July collections to the previous tax year. It seems to me like if we tax 2002 you could be collecting 2002 revenue until late filers like me filed in October 2003.
Yes. That's correct, Representative. There is a lag effect when the liability occurs, and what I explained earlier in response to Representative Devlin's question was that we first estimate liability. So we say, here's all the possible income tax liability we estimate for the 2002 tax year. Then we convert that to a collection. We assume there's a lag time there so that liability and collection are not synchronous. There's a lag between the two. Late filers are spilling over actually in the following year. So we've adjusted that by, we basically calibrate our liabilities, what we actually see coming in terms of collection. So we have models that estimate how long that lasts. Yeah. And that will pick up those things of delay payments.
Okay. Representative
Bates. Mr. Chair, the way I learned to think of this in my training in revenue session was that unfortunately the biennium for the state of Oregon does not match up with the federal tax year. And so whenever you change the tax schedule, you're talking about changing schedules not only that year for the federal tax schedule, but you have to move it into the next part for the biennium to get the money and capture that money for your biennium. So you're just about always going to have to move your tax table at least 2 years to pick that up. I think that's the point you're trying to make. Pick up that January to July time. And that's where I think of in my head. It makes more sense to me. And you look at all the other things that come in late and averaging and all the things you collect. But the net result is you've got to think of it as a tax system that's not lined up directly with the subsidies or connected to them. But our biennium doesn't line up, so you have to move 2 years. Getting back to your point then, could you do 2 years only, capture the money you need to balance the budget and leave it there? I think you could. You could. That'd be a 2-year tax thing you have to look at, maybe spending another year if you wanted to. How big a problem you want to deal with the next time around? You want to leave enough pressure to get a change? You want to make so much pressure you can't move at all? I mean, there's lots of the full cost of the discussion, but I think you got to go for at least 2 years and consider a third year.
You're convincing me on that.
You got to go at least 2 years. You know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that would be basically, even though it wouldn't be synchronous with our biennium, it would be in lieu of the 2 years of this biennium. We have a 2-year biennium, which runs from July to June 30 of alternate years, and so we tax for 2 years, 2002-2003, and those assets are attributed to this biennium. Not the future money. Maybe trouble is you. Who knows what's going to happen in the next biennium?
Or, I mean, say it's too cute by half, but enact it for, and ask the voters permission, enact it for 2 years, and then in the wisdom of the body, you know, extend it for one more year based on
what we're doing.
Yeah, where we are.
Mr. Chairman, I think that everyone here has made a good case for not having this be a 2-year tax, that there is a sensible reason for it to be a 2-year tax, and that that's a sensible thing to do.
You better get closer to your microphone.
I think that my position on the whole issue of taxes is very well known, and we're way beyond where I want to go, even with a 2-year tax. But for purposes of moving the discussion forward here and getting to a place where we can actually have a bill draft that we can work on, I would submit that a 2-year tax is what we should be putting on the table.
Okay.
Chair, if I could change subjects for a moment.
Sure.
Senator Shields, before he left, asked me to ask, I thought, a kind of pertinent question that we never quite covered earlier. Paul, the Senator would like to know if the fact we cut off this tax at $50,000,
and try to make that a neutral situation. If we cut people at 6,000 below, didn't pay on this and this new tax, how much would that affect the 9.6? Would it go to 9.7, 9.75? Kind of where would that affect that? Just, you just wanted to know that information. I mean, it's a good question.
Well, to make a question based, the question would be, should we exempt those joint filings in ADI less than
50,000,
single filers less than 25, and make up for it with a higher cost rate?
What would that
be? Revenue neutral.
Let's take a look at that.
Look at the list if we get this down. Okay. We can do that. We'll have that for you.
Paul, I'm looking at the, and maybe Elizabeth knows the answer. On the revenue impact statement, you've shown $395.5 million for the 0203 biennium. If we were to make this, and then 305, if it's a two-year tax, how much revenue does that carry forward into the 0305 biennium?
We have looked at 2 and 3 year. We have a table that compares those, but I don't believe we have these precise rates in that. We can get that very quickly, but you can see what happens, and the 0405 is dropped off because it doesn't apply the 05, so actually you're missing out withholding. But the amount of revenue generated on an annual basis is starts off in the 02 tax year as being more than $200 million, and so your liability per year is probably going to be in the neighborhood of $140 million, something like that. So we can get that precise.
Anyone
yet
in attendance want to comment on duration? A lot of discussion. Pretty specific terms here.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Speaker.
Can you summarize what you hear as the nearest consensus of the committee?
Well, I think this falls into the 5248. bracket, or is it 48-52? The consensus I think I hear is to include the corporate tax,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know where we are on duration. If Representative Shetterly would help me with that, I would have a consensus.
Or does your Representative Morgan suggest in 2 years?
Well, I'm kind of pretty good with the rest of the committee. I need input from...
Well, I'm waiting. I didn't know that was going to be the question tonight.
I didn't know that was going to be the question tonight either. And this is, I mean, again, we are talking in conceptions based on discussion tonight.
Elizabeth tells me that the revenue going forward to the 2003-05 biennium from a two-year temporary tax increase would be about $177.6 million. That's revenue into the 03-05 biennium for a tax that essentially would end on December 31 of 2003. I don't have a real strong feeling one way or the other. On the one hand, if you're going to ask the voters for a temporary tax increase, might you just as well get someone that's going to help you through the next biennium. On the other hand, if you go 2 years, does it make it easier to pass, perhaps, as a lesser package? So this is new discussion, so I'm willing that... I'll vote for it either way, I guess.
Mr. Speaker, I think it's fair to say we don't have a consensus on it.
Well, the reason I asked for the discussion is that I'd like to have this bill signed, sealed, delivered to the Senate tomorrow.
And the more we can have these discussions and know where we're going to start in the morning, the better off we are, and the quicker we will be able to move. And that's why my persistence on the issue.
I think it's fair. I think everyone knows. Just a little bit off the topic, but just so everyone in attendance knows, and those listening, the committee has been posted for 9 a.m. tomorrow. We have Treasury coming back, and we will put the finishing touches on the bonding piece. So we'll be back here at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Now, back on point. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate what the speaker is trying to do by using this committee as a snapshot of what might represent consensus. We have struggled for 9 days in a rather elaborate negotiating process that has included input of all of our colleagues. And I would feel quite reticent to perhaps mislead the speaker in his search for consensus that the few folks that sit here are truly reflective of the caucus, at least our caucus. And so I just share that while taking the temperature of this committee is probably useful and instructive, we have had a rather inclusive previous process, and I don't want anyone leaving believing anything that comes out of this is definitive.
Well, and I can appreciate that, Representative Johnson, but you having said that, I've got to say this. I mean, this is how it's supposed to work, and that the consensus of this committee, or the majority of this committee, is what will shape this tax policy, not negotiations that went on for 9 days with some progress, but not, not a definite conclusion. I mean, what this committee comes up with is what's going to be on the floor. And so that's why the speaker, very sincerely, very graciously, is asking for this consensus. And I think you're hearing, you know, a mixed bag here as well, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Chairman. I know this is not what the speaker is looking for, but at the same time, I hear more consensus in this committee than I hear amongst members as a whole.
Very observant.
Yeah. Richard, you're 50 years old today?
39.
Excuse me for misspeaking. I mean, I jump on base for a little slip.
My 11th annual celebration, my 39th birthday.
You can jump on me for making that slip.
Mr. Chairman, if I could make it two. I think I'm not going to get to the issue of referral versus enactment, but if we get to the point where, and I'm speaking actually for the members, not solely for myself, if we get to the point where we are discussing that we know that it's going to simply be a referral, I think it's then appropriate actually at that point to discuss whether or not what will impact the public's willingness to support it or not support it. So I think that gets to your other question about what the length of the tax is. Yeah. That's a legitimate discussion.
I agree. Okay. I think how this impacts the voters, does this increase the chances of passage? Does this hurt the chances of passage? You know, that's one thing. The campaign side of it, the public policy is another question. It's something we've all got to wrestle with here. And reflects on this time issue is when it first started up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was listening very carefully when Representative Shetterly speaks, and I think that one of the things that he, point that he made tonight that I'd like to retake for emphasis is seeing how the package looks in its entirety will also be useful to all of us. We're looking at a small portion of a larger package, and I guess I don't. I would hate to have anybody walk away with the belief that the appearance of consensus among this committee is the possible.
Any clear, Mr. Speaker?
What kind of amendment are you going to have drafted into the committee's consideration in the morning?
Mr. Chair, I think maybe to move this thing along tonight, Let's have a two-year amendment drafted, and let's have a corporate amendment drafted. I guess the consideration would be, again, in light of the package, then would there be another amendment looking at a revenue-neutral impact of adding in the corporate so that you are reducing, you're not increasing the total size of the tax increase.
So that would be three.
Or I guess the corporate would come in two fashions. One would be just addition, and one would be reducing the personal income tax rates to essentially make this revenue neutral. And then we could vote on it.
And for your purposes, Mr. Speaker, there isn't going to be any mocks going on this committee in the morning. We're going to do the bond piece just as quickly as they get here. We'll do the tax piece. And I'm hopeful that we can get that to first reading by session 11 o'clock.
Chair.
Yeah, oh, that's right. We can't work this. We can't work this until
we get heard.
It's heard, and you send it back in.
The final look. You've had a lot of discussion tonight,
right.
And I think that'll be helpful for in the morning. And we need to be talking about something that we'll be willing to go back and recommend. The members of this committee can go back and recommend to their caucus. I think that's the best we're going to get. Then we need to run the bill.
And I think we've aired most of the issues here tonight. Did Representative Morgan or Cedric?
The administrator here. I guess it's the lateness of the hour, Paul, but what is Section 4 doing?
What that does is sunset it.
Okay.
So it applies only to tax years through 2004, January 1, 2005. It's sunset. One thing I might point out, if you get into the corporate discussion tomorrow in terms of tax years, and you talked about the calendar year for personal income tax, corporations have a staggered year. So they actually select what their tax year is. So they've got tax years ending literally every month of the year. So you do have a different kind of a timing effect on the corporate side. So the draft can say, or the bill can say for tax years beginning January 1, 2002, well, for some corporations, you know, it may actually be November 1, 2002, when they tax year.
Thank you for your comment.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
So if we could amend LTs and we were going to do it, then the only change we would have to do to get to 2 years, Paul, would be to amend line 1, page 5, to say January 1, 2003.
For the personal.
For the personal.
For to amend the January 1, 2004 for 2 years, January 1, 2003 for 1 year.
Okay. Thank you. But that's the only change we'd have to make in this. That and the summary. Okay.
Pretty
simple
change. Sometimes simple things are the hardest.
Yes, it's challenging. I'm sorry I was gone for a moment there, Mr. Chair. I had to step out to talk about some other issues. There is a concern from going from 3 to 2 years. President Shirley knows that 9 days ago, or it was like 9 years ago, we discussed this issue, and there was a big discussion about whether or not we really wanted to go with 2 or 3. And what that would affect be in the next plan. And we've discussed that again tonight. I just want you to know that not everyone would necessarily feel going from 3 to 2 would be appropriate thing to do. Others would feel it's appropriate. Others like to go to 0. But I want you to know, right, beginning, you may not have the answer to vote on this tomorrow comes up, too, so you know. The other issue is one we're not talking about tonight, and I'm not going to bring up, but that there may be other amendments off in some of the quarters that could affect that also. It would be unfair not to let you know that.
Delicately put, Roger Sanders. Thank all of you in attendance very much. I mean, this is important, and as you can see and you've been through, there are no easy answers here. We will adjourn the committee. No other business to report.
from 9 a.m.
Yeah.
To tomorrow morning.
I wasn't ready for any harmful.